Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Life Sciences Revolution podcast. I'm your host, Alex Wise, and today we're going to be chatting with Martine Varsovsky. Martine is a serial entrepreneur in the realm of fertility and is the founder of Prelude Life, the largest fertility clinic network in North America. Although Martine is currently working in the fertility space, he's been very active in other areas as well, such as telecommunications and renewables, and has founded five unicorn companies which have gone on to reach billion-dollar-plus valuations. It was a pleasure having Martine on the podcast to chat about the ideas behind infertility and the issues his companies are facing in the realm today, and I hope you enjoy hearing from him as much as I did. So now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Martine Varsovsky. So before we get into the weeds with your different companies and IVF and your career path and other topics, I always like to give our audience a solid baseline to understand and stick with the conversation. So as a serial entrepreneur in the realm of fertility and the lack thereof, can you give us a quick introduction to what infertility is, why it's becoming much more prevalent today, and why it's such a big issue?
Well, at the time of the baby boomers, they were called baby boomers because they had babies, and they had babies because they had them in their 20s. And if you want to have babies in your 20s, it mostly works. And when it doesn't work, it tends to be evenly divided into infertility by causes related to men and related to women. But then as we changed generation-wise and we went to millennials as the main group of people having children now, they want to have their children in the 30s and 40s. And about a third of the people who try to have children in the 30s and 40s fail during their lifetime in achieving their maternity or paternity goals. So it mainly has to do with age.
All right, so my understanding is that there's a growing disconnect between the biological and societal drives for having babies. You know, there are the issues with variability in IVF procedure quality and the access and the cost of having children. But if I'm not mistaken, there's actually a pretty staggering statistic where around 19% of women who want to have babies are not able to. And then there's an additional 22% of women who are not able to have a second baby with so-called secondary infertility. So essentially you have this misalignment with the new age at which people want to have children and the biological age at which it's easier to have children per se. So what are some of the options for people to have children in their later years? How does IVF and how do fertility clinics work into the paradigm to bridge this gap between the biological and the societal sides of fertility?
Well, as the founder of Prelude Fertility, the largest chain of clinics in the United States with a corporate name of Inception, and as now the chairman of Inception, together with my co-founder, TJ Farnsworth, we built and grew a lot of clinics, IVF clinics throughout the USA with the purpose of helping people start a family whenever they're ready. The being ready is key because, as I was saying before, what happens now is people are ready later in life. And they're ready later in life because there's been a disconnect between people's psychology and people's biology. Like, we're programmed to have children much earlier than we're at the age we're trying to have them. And therefore, we fail. So a way to avoid infertility is fertility preservation or egg freezing. It's not a guarantee, but it greatly increases the chances for women to have babies in their late 30s and 40s if they have frozen eggs earlier on in life. So we are the leading providers of fertility preservation. The method, what we call the Prelude method, involves freezing gametes early in life, let's say at least under the age of 35. We haven't worked a great deal on men, but men should also freeze their sperm, and we can talk about that later as to why. But women should certainly freeze their eggs if they would like to have babies after 35. So basically, you freeze gametes, you freeze eggs, you freeze oocytes, and then you make embryos when you're ready to have a baby. And then you transfer one embryo at a time to avoid multiple pregnancies. You can also genetically test the parents and the embryos to avoid illnesses. So that's what we call the Prelude method, and that's a way to greatly increase the chances of having a baby.
Gotcha. Well, Thanks for giving us a little bit of a intro to Prelude there, which is your chain of fertility clinics and is also the largest network of fertility clinics in North America. You guys are in over 35 cities in the US and Canada. So can you tell us a bit more about who are the ideal candidates for IVF?
Well, the average age of the women who come to Prelude clinics is 38. 38 begins to be quite a difficult age to reliably have children. And the IVF process involves a consultation, an initial consultation, trying to understand the reasons for the infertility. Infertility is defined as trying to make a baby having sex for over 6 months and failing after the age of 35, or over 12 months and failing under the age of 35. And so the people who come and see us, they have tried to make babies having sex and haven't been able to do so. We also need to do spermograms and analysis on the man's sperm to see that we're not dealing with the male factor, or sometimes you deal with both. So you try to assess the causes of infertility. And then once it's decided that the best course is IVF, the process involves an initial consultation and then five other consultations with ultrasounds, the taking of medication that is called FSH or gonadotropins, and the taking of a trigger, most commonly used a Lupron trigger to avoid overstimulation, and then a retrieval where the eggs are retrieved. And then they're either frozen, and that's called fertility preservation, or they're used to make embryos, and that's called IVF.
So when it comes to the age groupings, you have the people who are a little bit older, who are experiencing or right before the period of time in which you are statistically more likely to experience infertility. And then there's this group of younger people who are acting in advance to protect and preserve their ability to have children later down the line. So to any young women, and I guess also men, who are listening to this conversation, do you recommend that they immediately go out after this and freeze their eggs or their sperm, or is that maybe a bit of an unnecessary overstep?
Well, I think that sperm freezing is certainly something easy for men to do, and there's a significant evidence that ability to make healthy babies goes down as the age of the man increases. So I would recommend to most men who think they may have children later in life to do it, and because it's not a difficult thing to do for men. For women to massively recommend to do egg freezing can be a dangerous thing in the sense that in some societies, the state pays for these type of things. And so it would be a great cost for the government to pay for women to massively do egg freezing, although some states pay for it, like the state of Israel, but it's not that common. So I think it has to be an individual decision whether a woman would like to do this or not. I have seven children myself, and they go from ages of 31 to 5. And I love being a dad. And I had no idea I was going to have seven children when I was in my 20s or early 30s when I started having them. And I think nobody knows what's going to happen to their life. But I know very few people who've been sorry about having children. Let's say it's not the kind of decision people tend to regret. Sometimes people regret who they had them with, but not having children. And so I think having children is a wonderful thing. Being a parent is a wonderful thing. Being holding little hands in my hand for 30 years. And it's something that I'm happy to be involved with and recommend to other people. So fertility preservation or egg freezing will greatly increase your chances of achieving whatever number of children you're thinking of having. So I do recommend it. I think it's something that is somewhat uncomfortable, no doubt about it, but it's a small discomfort compared to the pregnancy, giving birth, waking up at night with your baby. Like having children is never a comfortable thing, whether you do egg freezing or not. It's something that is difficult, but highly rewarding.
It sounds like the egg freezing and sperm freezing process is really about getting ahead of the game, you know, essentially having the option to go through with having kids later in life and to give yourself the most possibilities out there. So I'm curious how you ended up going down this path, switching from previous ventures and ending up in the fertility realm. Now, I know you mentioned that you've had seven children yourself, so I'm not sure if you wanted to get involved in the fertility space to make sure that everyone has the option to have as many kids as you, but what prompted the switch?
Well, before being an entrepreneur focused on fertility, I was focused on renewable energy, wind and solar. I built a unicorn in that field called Eolia. Before that, I built two telecom companies, also now worth around 10 billion and 1.3 billion, and a consumer internet company. So I was not focused on this, but think about the following situation. An entrepreneur who thinks like an entrepreneur walks into an IVF clinic because he's having issues with his wife having a child and looks at the IVF clinic and looks at the system and just believes that it is not scalable, that the IVF industry was like a cottage industry that couldn't scale. And I started realizing that my problem could be many people's problem because many people want to have babies later in life, and many people are facing difficulties. And I decided to raise the first 100 million and focus on, let's say, being free from the biological clock, like to try to allow people to have control over their biological clock. And then that's how, as an entrepreneur who had infertility issues myself with my wife, Nina, it was then that I said this industry has to scale up and has to be more science-based, and there has to be more sharing and not individual clinics having their own baby-making recipes that are not shared. And I felt if we had a shared practice, we could achieve more and we could make more people happy. And that was the origin of Prelude.
So it's the classic entrepreneurial mindset of finding inefficiencies, trimming the fat, and making sure that the issues you've come across don't exist the next time someone else comes along and goes down the same path that you did. And you've alluded to it now, but I know that you've had some of your kids with parts of the technology stack that you have at Prelude, and there are obviously a number of steps in the IVF process. So could you tell us a bit of what it's like being on the patient side of your own venture?
Yes, yeah, so my wife and I did both egg freezing and sperm freezing. We did also IVF. We did genetically tested embryos. We even did a new type of amnio that is focused on microdeletions and other type of chromosomal abnormalities that are not normally caught by an IPT. We went really for our last child, Ben. We did everything that we could possibly do, and we have a wonderful 5-year-old, very healthy and fun to be with. I guess I did all those things because I believe in science and medicine, but I did them also because I think when you have 6 children and you're about to have your seventh, there's a saying that says that you're only as happy as your saddest child. You want to, if you have one child with significant problems, it does make your parenting much more difficult. And I wanted to do anything that science could do to increase the chances that I would have a healthy baby. So we went through everything, the full menu of options, and we ended up having a wonderful child called Ben. So, yes, we ourselves have practiced what we preach.
Exactly. You're really an entrepreneur who's practicing what he preaches, you know. You're ensuring that if someone else is going to be using these services, then you're also comfortable with using them yourself. You've also started a few other companies in the fertility realm, Overture Life and Gamedo. And if Prelude is aimed at overhauling the fertility clinic itself, then Overture is aimed at overhauling the fertility clinic benchtop and changing how those IVF procedures are done. Because as of right now, there's a large human component to the process, which can introduce variability and, of course, errors. So, can you tell us a bit more about Overture, the company's status, and how you guys are working to standardize the IVF process to make IVF not only cheaper, but also more accessible?
Yes. So indeed, what happened is after building Prelude and becoming then chairman and having TJ Farnsworth become CEO through the merger with Inception, and after really seeing what a wonderful job he's doing based out of Houston to manage our clinics, and I went on to start Overture. Overture, I'm the CEO of Overture. It's a company that is automating the embryology lab using a technology known as microfluidics and biochips. The idea is to imitate what's happening in embryology labs manually, but to automate it. We're also working on a robot that does ICSI. ICSI is an injection of sperm in an egg. And that is also a manual process. So we're automating egg freezing, ICSI, IVF, because we want IVF and egg freezing to be accessible to more people, and we want it to be more standardized. Right now, clinics have a great variability of results depending on the quality of their embryology lab. In our latest trials, we were beating the best embryologies using our biochips. We have to see if this is sustainable, and we're doing more trials, but the indications are very good. And that doesn't mean you don't need embryologies. Of course, you need embryologies, but they can be much more reliable and productive and less prone to error. So we're trying to reduce the possibility of a distraction in all these manual processes like the cryotope method for egg freezing and consistency in results. So Overture has raised $37 million so far. It's invested by Kosla Ventures and Felicis and Google Ventures and Mark Benioff and Octopus. And we're very proud of the work we're doing to automate the embryology lab. And recently, I started another fertility company called Gamito that has raised $23 million so far and is focused on ovarian aging, which is the root cause of infertility. And the cause for infertility and menopause, because menopause and infertility are both come from ovarian aging. So I'm very involved in the field of fertility in the clinical world, in the embryology equipment, and in the therapeutics.
Certainly attacking all the different heads of the fertility and embryology realm there. And really quick, you mentioned ICSI. And so maybe for those who don't have a background in fertility, can you tell us what ICSI is and how it differs from other IVF procedures?
Yes, when you fertilize an egg, you can fertilize it by bringing sperm to the proximity of the egg, and the process occurs naturally, and that's called natural insemination. And it works pretty well when the sperm is of good quality and the men have a high sperm count and good motility and good sperm overall. But when they don't, ICSI is a great solution. So in the process of ICSI, an embryologist at the embryology lab identifies a single sperm, one sperm, picks up the sperm under a microscope and actually injects it in an egg manually. So it's a process in which you're trying to help nature. You're trying to pick up the sperm that doesn't swim well, that doesn't go where it's supposed to go, and you inject it inside an oocyte. But the problem of this process is that it's prone to error because it's done by humans who are doing their best, but it's not so easy to do this. It's a very difficult thing to do. It takes a lot of training. So we built a robot that does this and does it very well. And we're improving, of course, the robot to automate ICSI.
So you mentioned helping nature. I think that's a really key phrase when you're talking about the realm of infertility. And whenever I hear anything about helping nature, and then also on top of it, babies and embryos, then my mind always jumps to the ethics side of the topic. There are obviously a multitude of different ethical issues and considerations in the field of fertility with respect to discarding embryos, gene editing of embryos, genetic testing, and access to IVF and pregnancy-related services. So I wanted to know, what are some of the most prevalent considerations that everyone at Prelude, Gamito, and Overture all keep in mind when working in this field?
Yes, it is a field that you have many, many ethical considerations, and it is complicated because in the United States, it's largely a self-regulated field. In other countries, it is highly regulated by the government, for example, in Germany. But the result is that many more IVF babies can be born in the United States because sometimes the regulation overreaches. But there has to be regulation in the sense that there's a societal need that's being met, and it's difficult for clinics to know what are the right decisions. So you can have ethical committees and so on. I'll give you one example. Women can get reliably pregnant at the age of 60 if they use frozen eggs from when they were 30, or if they use donor eggs, right? Or if they have high quality embryos left over from when they were, let's say, 39. But should you help a 60-year-old woman to get pregnant, right? And why would that be a problem, right? And the answer is not medical, because not all women, but many women at the age of 60 could have babies. Their uterus works. The problem is with the eggs, but if you have frozen eggs, donor eggs, frozen embryos, you solve that problem. So sometimes we get older women who want to use their embryos, or it's not common, but it happens. And the question is, should you have a limit age at which you should do this? I mean, why not 55? Why not 60? Why not 65? Why not 70? These are difficult questions that we face. Should there be one rule for everybody? What about the fitness of the woman, the life expectancy of this woman? What about her genetics? That's just one issue. There's other issues concerning surrogacy. Surrogacy is banned in many countries, but it's allowed in the United States. If you want to help gay men to have babies, the only way is to use surrogates, right? And so many European gay men travel to the US so they can have babies with surrogates, because that's not allowed in Europe or most places. Should it be ethical to allow surrogacy? On one side, you're helping gay men. On the other side, women go through pregnancy for carrying a baby for someone else. These are ethical issues. In the United States, it's been decided that it's acceptable under certain regulation, but not in every state. So even individual states of the United States have different laws about surrogacy. Then you have issues with gender selection. At our clinics in the US, we can select a boy or a girl, which is fine in my opinion. And now I'm just going to give my own personal opinion, but it's not fine with certain ethnic groups that have an incredible preference for boys. Right. So me personally, I don't think it's good to have a society that only has boys or many boys or no girls, or to have a gender imbalance. But when patients come, they say they want a boy, we have to comply, because in that case, it's legal to do gender selection. It would be also very problematic to say yes to a certain ethnic groups, or, for example, to say you can do gender selection, but only to select girls. So I am conflicted by this. I don't even know what's the right thing to do. I am in favor of gender selection when somebody has three boys and want a girl, or three girls want a boy. Like, I'm totally in favor of that. But I'm not in favor of a systematic discrimination against girls. But we don't know how the patients are making these decisions. But I'm just sharing with you examples of ethical issues that we have to deal with. The last one maybe would be designer babies, right? Like, I am in favor of using genetic testing to avoid illnesses. That I think makes a lot of sense to me, in the sense that when people say they'd like a baby, they want a healthy baby, not a baby that lives a horrible, difficult life and dies at the age of three. Right? And many illnesses can be prevented with genetic testing of embryos, especially monogenic illnesses. Now, some people are saying, no, I'd like to have a good looking baby, a tall baby, an intelligent baby. And that is not so easy to do now, but we're beginning to learn how to do that, those multigenic. I mean, it's complicated because we don't really understand what the genes that code for certain things. Certainly beauty is very difficult to code for. And we don't even agree on what beauty is. Let's say we kind of have a general understanding, but not an agreement. So I'm not for designer babies, me personally. I am for avoiding illnesses. But some companies are in favor of that. And again, there's certain ethnicities believe that it's ethical to try to make an intelligent baby, the only people who have made CRISPR babies are the Chinese. CRISPR being a gene editing technique that allows you to screen for desirable genes and avoid undesirable genes. So it is possible to make CRISPR edited babies, and it's been done in China, but most people are not in favor of that. So there's many, many ethical issues involved with what we do. I encourage societal involvement in these issues, because sometimes we just don't know what is the right thing to do, even though we try to do the most ethical thing we could possibly do.
Right, and if I'm not mistaken, when it comes to the CRISPR edited babies and genetic editing of embryos as a whole, that you mentioned took place in China, there was a lot of uproar, or maybe uproar, that might be an imprecise word there, but at the very least, a lot of concern and issues that arose there. And so, editing as such is something that's not done in the US, right?
No, I mean, it cannot be done. It was done in China, but it's not clearly understood what kind of permission there was. And I understand the doctor who did this, doctor, he is in legal trouble for doing this, but it was done. And there are people now, their germline has been edited, and their children will have these edits. So it's something that has happened. I personally believe that embryo selection is better than embryo gene editing. But I, having said this, in order to select embryos, you have to have a lot of embryos or different embryos. And sometimes older couples only give you one embryo and there's nothing to select, or they give you no embryo, so they give you very few. But anyway, embryo selection is a good way to avoid monogenic illnesses. Gene editing could also be a good way to avoid monogenic illnesses, but we're not there yet. We don't know exactly what happens. You may knock out a gene and create unforeseen results. Let's say we know how to do certain things, but we don't know all the consequences, and we need trials for that.
Sure. And so when it comes to the embryos and implanting embryos, if I'm not mistaken, at Prelude, you guys do single embryo transfer, right? And there are obviously some religious considerations that some people may have when it comes to choosing the best embryo and then from a batch and then discarding embryos. And I imagine there can be a big issue, per se, if you were to find out via genetic testing that an embryo has problems or potentially would have problems, and then the patient had qualms with discarding embryos. So, do you guys have any procedures in place to help work around those types of situations?
Well, let's point this out, that there are some religions that have issues with certain aspects of the world of IVF. This is not all religions, but some religions believe that life begins at conception, and therefore it is possible to do an IVF process tailored for people with those beliefs. Okay. The most troubling aspect of IVF with people with those beliefs is the discarding of embryos, right? They're not using embryos. So you can then freeze eggs, not embryos, freeze eggs. And then you can make one embryo at a time and transfer it at that moment. So they will never be discarded. So there is a way to do IVF for people with beliefs that life begins at conception. If you have leftover embryos, there's also the donation of embryos. You can donate an embryo, just like you can donate, well, I don't know if the word would be donate, but you can give a child for adoption. You can also give an embryo for adoption, let me put it that way, for people who believe that embryos are people, which is not a shared belief and it's not legally understood like that, but everybody's entitled to believe whatever they'd like to believe. And in that case, they would be sort of doing embryo, quote unquote, adoption. Right? Another couple would have this embryo. So there are solutions for certain groups who believe in this. And the solution is to make only one embryo at a time, not discard embryos. And if you have leftover embryos, to give them up for adoption or donate them.
Gotcha. And maybe we can come back to the conception issue here. There's been a lot of talk recently about the ethical and legal discussions centered around this topic. And as I'm sure you and everyone else is very well aware, the US Supreme Court has moved in the direction to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is an absolutely egregious blow against women's reproductive rights. And this could have global ramifications in terms of how governments worldwide view women's reproductive rights and abortions. And so, being a thought leader in the fertility space, how could this potentially affect access to IVF and fertility services as a whole? And what's the direction you see this going?
Well, I don't think this will affect IVF clinics or IVF. I don't think this relates to abortion. It may deal with the subject of what to do with embryos, which, of course, there is another solution with embryos, that embryos can last hundreds of years frozen or forever. You can freeze them forever. There's no indication that once an embryo is in liquid nitrogen, that there's any kind of deterioration of embryos. We've been doing IVF since 1979, and we could get embryos frozen in the 80s and have babies now. So you can also deal with the issue of embryos by just keeping them frozen forever, which is not also so expensive. But going back to the rights of women to choose what to do with their pregnancies, I think that it is very important that women should be allowed to decide by themselves what to do with their pregnancies. I am very disappointed at the leaked decision, and I don't know what the consequences will be. We have to wait. I already saw some states like Oklahoma trying to pass legislation that is completely bans abortion. I think that it's a tragedy not to be able to have a baby, but it's also a tragedy to be forced to have a baby against your will. I believe in people's right to choose. Regarding the rights of the unborn, I am going to say something that may be a little controversial, but I think Europe nailed it and America didn't on what is the right thing to do. I do not believe abortions should be freely done at any time during the pregnancy. I believe that when a baby is viable, that you may say when, but after week 30, let's say, in the last weeks, it wouldn't be what I call an abortion if a baby can be born and breathe on her own. In Europe, there is access to abortion, of course, generally without difficulty, but their term limits are 14 to 24 weeks. In America, sometimes the debate is between unrestricted right to abortion and no abortion whatsoever. And I think Europe did the right thing, which is abortion should be a choice until the baby is viable, right? And that part, I think that there should be some consideration by the people who are in favor of the woman to choose. While I consider not a sound argument that a baby should be, say, to consider a three-day embryo or a five-day non-implanted embryo baby, I consider that frankly absurd. But I do consider a seventh-month baby who's viable and who could breathe. Then I do consider this very controversial to do a late-term abortion. So in Europe, it's very simple. There's a limit. And if you pass that limit, then you have to have the baby. That makes sense to me. But America, which as usual in many things is the land of extremes, has gone from one extreme to the other. And I hope there's a common middle ground that is found that is reasonable. And I hope this conversation and these comments of mine do not make a lot of people be against me, because clearly I am in favor of the right of women to choose, but not after the time the baby is truly viable.
That's certainly true. The U.S. is typically the land of extremes, the all or nothings. And hopefully this doesn't turn out being a full drop down to 0%. And but you mentioned some places in Europe are more moderate with their cutoff points after fetus viability. So I guess we'll have to see how this plays out in the near future. Last question on the topic of ethics and access. When it comes to fertility clinics, when we're speaking about, we've been speaking about the U.S., maybe we can stick with that geography, but what does the cost look like to the patient in these situations? Is anything going to be covered here?
Well, every country has different policies vis-a-vis access to IVF. On average, in Asia, in Europe, USA, Latin America, it's, I would say, many times out of pocket, many times. Even when it's covered, it's many times out of pocket, which leads to an injustice, which is that wealthy people have a much greater chance of starting a family than poor people. I believe that anybody who wants to start a family should be able to start a family. In the US, this is covered by what's called mandated or non-mandated states. So certain states are such that if you want to offer medical insurance, you have to offer IVF coverage. I believe there's 19 states like that, and the rest of the states are non-mandated. So it's not equal across the United States. In Europe, it is covered by the state, but only in many times under conditions that it's kind of like when they say that the only time you have a friend at JP Morgan is when you don't need a friend at JP Morgan. Well, here it's like the only time you have the state paying for IVF is when you don't need IVF. But then when you need it, they say you're over a certain age, no IVF. You have an AMH that's low, no IVF. So what happens in many of these countries is that people are covered, but not really covered, because then they, when they really need IVF, they cannot get it. Then they have to go to private clinics who do generally a very good job trying to fill the gap. So the cost of IVF is a big issue. But in my other companies, like Overture and Gamito, we're also focused on lowering the cost of IVF with complete different means. One is automated embryology lab at Overture. And at Gamito, we're studying the root cause of ovarian aging, trying to see if we can come up with ways of making women fertile longer in life, or trying to increase the yields from IVF by making immature eggs mature. In those cases, we will make it possible to go beyond that wall that we have hit so far of 40% success or a certain limited success. I mean, 40% success per try. Of course, if you do many IVFs, you increase your chances, but Gamito wants to go beyond that. And so I am working on efforts to make IVF more affordable, but also more doable, because many times it's not a question of money. You know, all the money in the world is not going to get you a baby under certain circumstances, no matter how many IVFs you try, if you don't make eggs, or if you only make immature eggs. But if you can find ways of making eggs later in life, maturing eggs later in life, it's a question of you're solving a problem that right now money cannot buy.
Right. Biology certainly does not care about how much money you have, but I'm glad to hear that Overture and Gamito are working to move IVF in the direction of more democratized access to these services as a whole. So let's switch gears here for the last question. As we've mentioned, you know, your path in entrepreneurship has taken many twists and turns. You grew up in Argentina, started various companies in telecommunications and renewables, and then switched over in the direction of fertility, I think you said in 2016. And I once heard you say in an interview that entrepreneurs have an intolerance for inefficiency. And I'm going to quote you on this next part, even though the interview was in Spanish. So I apologize to all the native Spanish speakers listening for my accent, but preferiremos caminar por una selva con un machete que caminar por una ruta asfaltada y ser una más. So if I got that right, it was that you'd rather walk through a jungle with a machete to blaze your own path as opposed to taking the paved road, the easy path, and be just like everyone else. And so for those listening who have an idea for a company or want to know what to do when they have the idea so they can enact change in a field, what advice do you have for them?
Well, I occasionally teach entrepreneurship at Columbia University and have taught at NYU and other places. So I give advice when I teach, right? I also mentor entrepreneurs. So I give advice when I mentor. And I also have a pool of around $600 million of venture investing. So I also give advice when I invest. So I give advice when I invest, when I mentor, when I teach. And the problem of this format, the podcast format right now, is that there's no one piece of advice for all entrepreneurs. What I have to do is I have to study the individual situation that's being presented to me. And this situation may relate to a specific business that people have in mind. It's very hard to answer the question, should I be an entrepreneur? My answer generally to that question is no, because you're not telling me why you should be an entrepreneur. I mean, it's sort of like being an entrepreneur is super hard. It's many times fail. There's tremendous failure in being an entrepreneur. It's not like being a lawyer, an engineer, an architect, or a doctor, which you will, of course, encounter failure, but not as frequently as entrepreneurs encounter failure. So to me, entrepreneurs have to be those who can't possibly think of anything else. People who wake up and can't stand the world without their company. it has to be something drastic, something. When I was 22, my father died and we were left in a precarious financial situation. And my mother was pushing me to become an employee, not an entrepreneur, so we could make money as a family. And I had to support my grandmother. And I would go for job interviews and they would say, how do you see yourself in 5 years? And I would say, well, at least as your boss. Okay. And I would never get a job. But the same bank that didn't give me a job gave me $12 million to build my first company without knowing that I was also applying for a job there. And I believe I couldn't not be an entrepreneur. I didn't know what else to be. I could not stand being under the leadership of anyone else. I had to be my own leader. The example you use of the jungle, the machete, I had to build my own road. And so I think entrepreneurship should be reserved for those who cannot imagine themselves being anything else.
It's almost that innate desire to build your own path. And that's a good story with the interviews. I can't imagine why you never got the call back for a second round. But nonetheless, Martin, thank you for taking the time to chat today. It was a pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Life Sciences Revolution podcast with Martin Warsawski. I hope you enjoyed, and if you did, make sure to check out some of our other episodes. And now, here's In Motion by Jank Setup to close us out.